Welcome to Variant Frequencies. Month to month, our podcast brings you fiction stories from a different channel. Sci-fi, fantasy, horror, and some odd bands in between. Visit us at www.variantfrequencies.com. This story is a first for us here at Variant Frequencies. It is our first story written by a guest author. The Spoils of War is written by DJ Burnham and narrated by Rick Stringer. We hope you like it. Your comments are always welcome. Be sure to stick around for the message at the end of our podcast from a friend of ours. And all I can tell you about it is, I comply. And now, it is time for The Spoils of War. The Spoils of War by DJ Burnham. Parayan swept her arm across the dirty wooden floorboards, scattering the last of the remaining die-cast miniature troops in a cloud of dust. She'd done it 1,000 times before, employing every strategy that her late father had taught her time and time again. She never grew tired of it and didn't even know what a doll would look like. This was all she knew. When all of the other toys of antiquity had long since been broken, lost, or worn beyond repair, the only new manufacturer gaining Central Command's approval was that of the model troops. Life outside of the vast armored bunkers was unspeakably dangerous, and there was no room for boisterous pastimes within. Wargaming was encouraged and praised as cultivating a militaristic mentality in the young had become the norm, and with it came an unquestioning hatred for the enemy. Its relentlessness was a sorry excuse for the escapism that a young child craves, even in settled times, and these were far from that. Parayan, satisfied with the conclusion of her endeavors, returned the battered soldiers to their heavy metal box and slid it under her bunk. She quickly rubbed a wet cloth over her face, ran her fingers across her close-cropped hair, and set off for the community hall. It was 100th day, and ever since she, or anyone else for that matter, could remember, the evening of that day was always spent in the company of those living in the district. The soldiers would take it in turn to be present, as their guard couldn't drop for a moment. The sense of occasion was overwhelming, and for a few precious hours they could draw comfort from their assembly. As they drew near, she ran ahead of her aunt, entering the hall at full tilt. The 12-year-old, whose name meant Little Flower, was rewarded by a burly foot soldier who swept her up in his muscular arms and swung her around before setting her down. He presented her with a slice of fruit from the central table. Parayan smiled broadly and nibbled at the delicate flesh, savoring every moment of its wondrous taste. They were all allowed to have one piece each, and then it would be another 100 days of dry old rations before the treat would be repeated. She sucked the last of the juice from her fingers and wiped them boyishly on her rough hand-stitched brown jacket. The fruits were cultivated in a handful of vast subterranean farms, fueled by artificial light fed by recycling every scrap of organic matter available. Mostly they were concerned with the production of high-protein staples. The few lucky cattle that lived down there were kept purely for their milk. But for the purposes of morale, there were a few farmers who produced fruit. They had hurled themselves at one another for decades. So long, in fact, that few could recall precisely how the interminable war had begun. But all were driven by the deep waters of lunatic conviction, which ran through generations, impervious to the futility of military stalemate. Propaganda had served its purpose long ago, superseded by loathing and unshakable conviction. fundamentally psychotic to an outsider. But to the population of this scourged planet, the axiom by which they lived their lives was effectively physical. By now, it was hard to tell the two sides apart. Even the children carried the gaunt, ashen appearances of their parents, nihilists from birth, agnostic for life. In less than a century, they had evolved deeply furrowed brows, and their hair was gray by late teens. Smile lines and ruddy cheeks were a thing of fantasy. On closer inspection, the clothes worn by one side of the conflict were slightly brown, the righteous, whereas those on the other had a gray tinge, the virtuous. But the people who shuffled about within them were practically identical. Planet Sferl's atmosphere was choked with smoke and dust, kicked up from the surface of the countless explosions of a ballistic nightmare, conjured up from a marathon arms race. Sunlight rarely penetrated the mantle, and even when it did, it only served to accentuate the destruction. Entire cities had been abandoned as pockmarked wasteland, countryside choked by spent munitions and unmarked graves, as the remaining wildlife cowered in crumbling bolt holes. Food was scarce, and as bland as the itchy garments that hung off them like sackcloth. Conditions were squalid, disease rife. All that kept both sides from suffering a catastrophic implosion of morale was their enjoyment of music. What precious resources remained, talisman from better times, were channeled into the sweet sounds of instruments and voices, united in song, transported by harmony, delivered from Hades. By now the singing had begun and 200 voices were raised in unison. 4 musicians played wind and string instruments, accompanied by an organist and 2 percussionists. All 7 were amplified such that they could lead the choir. This was the only luxury use of power and technology permitted by Central Command, as resources were far too meager to be wasted on anything other than that which had a military use and basic life support in the bunkers. The songs were of faith, hope, and victory, the hymns and anthems of righteous salvation, a paean to better times both past and future. The words had been sung so often across the generations, and with such fervor, that their meaning had become ingrained into them. This had occurred to such an extent that the greater part of the throng no longer considered the content on a conscious level, but were lifted in the euphoria of unity and mesmerized by the tonal vibrations in a trance-inducing state of bliss. Poreian was still too young, and the loss of her parents still too fresh in her memory to give herself over entirely. Nevertheless, she joined in and sang with all her might, happy to belong. Absorbing the joy and the adult's rapture, she stood with a group of 9 other children, ranging from 8 to 15 years of age. These skinny little urchins were the only youngsters present. The stress of endless conflict, poor diet, and sickness did nothing for levels of conception, and children were generally regarded with great fondness by the adults, especially on 100th day. At 16, they were sent for training, boys and girls alike, and with a low birth rate coupled with the consistent attrition of manpower, the overall population was inevitably declining. Tanks, aircraft, ordnance, automatic weapons, and the majority of rifles and pistols had all been rendered obsolete, ruined, and exhausted, along with the funds that had fed the monster. However, the Sfellrians were a resourceful race, and soon devised new methods of combat, as well as resurrecting old ones, such that swordsmanship made a comeback, along with designs for ancient catapults called trebuchets, which would fling flamers, heavy wooden balls coated in flaming tar, into the midst of the enemy. They built airships, air screw driven by coal-fired engines, the heat from which was piped from the gondola into the envelope to supplement the lift from the internal helium-filled ballonets, and to allow for buoyancy adjustments as the coal was used and cargo jettisoned. They could stay in the air for days, appearing silently in the night above unprotected, populated areas, to deliver flamers from the sky, as well as providing valuable surveillance information. Battles took place at sea again, as frigates were recommissioned, propelled by both oar and sail, weaving around the larger steam-driven battleships, protecting them from attack. Submarines were developed for attaching clock-detonated explosive charges to the hulls of stationary battleships. They were powered by an 8-man crew who laboriously turned a hand crank like a multiple brace and bit to rotate the propeller, which would carry them through the water. They would submerge by flooding ballast tanks, drawing air through long, narrow core pipes to the surface, but only having a short amount of time when they dived deeper before they ran out of oxygen. It was long enough to release a diver to attach the mine, but not always long enough to await his return. A similar principle was attempted on land, to drive recommissioned tanks, but the sheer weight made the task virtually impossible, and the lighter models could be flipped on their backs like turtles by a group of men levering them with tree trunks. While they continued to wage this primitive warfare, a new direction was developing in the Righteous Camp. The sole technical advancements were being made in relation to the reproduction of music. With so much happening in the raw environment of the battlefield, it was considered essential to raise the spirits of their troops, and the simplest way to achieve that was to play them music as they launched an attack. Naturally, as soon as one side started doing it, so the other side came back with their own amplified compositions, each side trying to drown out the melodies of their opponent. Before long, the frontline troops were blasting each other with escalating levels of unbearably discordant cacophonies to taunt and unnerve the enemy. The righteous scientists experimented with methods beyond standard amplification, and discovered that they could focus sound to within a very narrow band of considerable intensity. They recorded the most harsh and grating combination of notes imaginable, reversed the playback direction, fed the result through an output transducer, and aimed it at a colleague in the middle distance. One blast saw him fall to the floor with his hands over his ears, writhing in agony. They rushed to his position and arrived just as he was standing up again. He described intense pain and nausea, as well as a loss of balance, reveling in the outcome, despite his obvious discomfort. Within a month, the righteous troops had been equipped with similar devices, and the results were outstanding. They were able to pick off one soldier after another, rapidly driving them back and advancing their own position. Fear swept through the virtuous forces as the invisible weapons were unleashed on them. Commanding officers struggled to keep them at their positions, with tactical retreats occurring at an unprecedented rate. The righteous troops began to get cocky and started to celebrate for the first time in ages, breaking out precious reserves of triple distilled alcohol and bursting into song. Their own officers joined in, sensing their relief and the need for rejoicing in their success. Meanwhile, after failing to develop any form of effective ear protector, the Virtuous Tactical Operations Headquarters considered their options. They assembled a crack unit comprising mature, experienced soldiers who all had one thing in common. They hadn't been near the front line for some time because following explosions or combat injuries, they were all stone deaf. They underwent a rigorous period of training for a risky operation, which would involve superb coordination, consummate professionalism, and seemingly impossible levels of stealth. Setting off in two groups, the first headed behind the smallest known enemy position under the cover of dark, whilst the other group made their way directly towards it. The handful of righteous troops on night watch had grown sloppy as their constant barrage of sonic bullets had made them feel invincible. As the old virtuous soldiers made their move, the righteous troops were slow to react, surprised to see such a brazen assault. And it took them a moment to realize what was happening. Even then, they were lazy in their response. They had grown so overconfident in the power of their new weapons that they no longer bothered to carry many other forms of protection. They fired smugly at the advancing men, at first puzzled by the age of some of them, and then terrified when they realized that their response was utterly ineffectual. As they reached for what few swords they'd brought with them, the second group of virtuous soldiers suddenly appeared from behind and cut them down with practiced precision. Seizing the sonic devices, the virtuous soldiers quickly made their way back to the tactical operations officer. In no time at all, both sides were firing sonic bullets at each other, and the impasse returned once more. The righteous scientists went back to their research, and before long had developed a new device. This time they produced a different kind of hypersonic weapon. It caused no pain or nausea, nor disorientation or physical manifestation of any kind. It was far more subtle than that. Working on the principle that they had been able to transmit sounds, they reasoned that they should be able to project messages. Once again, a volunteer stood tremulously on the brow of a distant hill. This time, he didn't fall to the ground. He jumped up and down, clapping his hands together and cheering. He repeated the secret, randomly controlled phrase back to his colleagues. Now they could target a beam at individuals which could create a range of effects, from simple misdirection of troops to repeated auditory hallucinations, which could convince someone that they were going quietly mad, or even lead them to take their own life. The instances for use were more limited than the sonic bullets, but with carefully planned campaigns, the virtuous troops were misled by a targeted commanding officer and marched straight into a massive ambush. With practice, the righteous officers were able to direct the virtuous troops in any direction they wanted, but only when they were close enough to identify the commanding officer. So they had to be extraordinarily careful. Most of the time, they used the new hypersonic device to undermine the already precarious mental well-being of the enemy soldiers. Meanwhile, the virtuous scientists had been working along different lines and had been experimenting with ultrasound. Apart from a signaling device to highly trained dogs, it had little direct application in land warfare. But then they thought about trying it underwater. Drawing on their knowledge of cetacean sub-aqua bioacoustics, they adapted the sonic rifle design, with which they had been totally familiar. Following its seizure from the righteous troops and their own production of similar units for counteroffensive combat, their initial experiments confirmed that the ultrasonic wavelength traveled tremendously quickly through water, with little difference between fresh or salinated water. With the creation of a large hyperbolic dish, along the design principles of the sonic rifle, they found that they could also focus ultrasound, and tried it on some fish. The results were both spectacular and shocking. With another month's work, they developed a super-sensitive sub-aqua grid, which was not only capable of detecting movement in the water, but could produce an excellent standard of imaging such that individual types of fish could be identified. The scientists set up their equipment in one of the many docks that were engaged in repairing battleships and frigates. They employed their own divers to attach ultrasonic weapons to the keel of each ship, and then had them swim around in simulated maneuvers, pretending to place mines on the hulls. The grid followed every movement, easily distinguishing between man and fish, and the ultrasonic weapons tracked their every move, constantly focusing on head or chest, crosshairs on the monitoring equipment watched by the swiftly trained weapons officer. Satisfied that the system was working, all they had to do was wait. Sure enough, 3 nights later, enemy submarines were picked up entering the perimeter of the sub-aqua grid. 2 divers were released, one made for the largest of the virtuous battleships, the other made for a frigate. As one of them came within range, the weapons officer made delicate adjustments to the targeting mechanism, focused on the upper third of the enemy's skull, and fired. For a moment, the diver hesitated, then began thrashing around wildly before hanging limply in the water, occasionally twitching. The second came within range of the frigate's weapon, and this time it focused on his heart. The man clutched his chest, dropping the mine and struggling in the water, bubbles bursting from his mask as his panicked breathing drew heavily on his tank. Within moments, he too hung in the water, a subtle plume of blood trailing from the side of his mask. This time, they let the submarines escape. Far more effective for the enemy to hear of the terror of the underwater weapon than to finish the job. At least, on this occasion. They dragged the divers from the water and took them away for postmortems. The results matched their experimental findings with the laboratory fish. The first diver had still been alive when they got to him, but incapable of speech or voluntary movement, and died soon after. Widespread cerebral microtissue destruction had turned his brain into an amorphous jelly. The second diver was found to have suffered heart failure, brought on by ultrasonic disruption of the sinoatrial node. The system was deployed at all of the virtuous docks, and they wiped out several more attempts before the submarines stopped coming. As electronic components were requisitioned from every available source to feed the escalating sonic war, communications began to suffer seriously. The time had come around for 100th day again, but Piraeus sat miserably in her room, listlessly rolling the dice that would determine the fate of her toy soldiers. Her eyes were damp, but her sobs were over. Her aunt had informed her that 100th day had been indefinitely postponed. Piraeus didn't fully understand the reasons, but it had something to do with Central Command taking the equipment that made the musicians' instruments louder. There was some talk of having a rota so that fewer individuals would attend the hall each 100th day, such that the instruments could lead acoustically rather than be drowned out by the voices. But it could never be the same. Piraeus couldn't see why they had to have the instruments at all, as everyone knew the songs so well. She argued the case with her aunt for a while, but she insisted that it had something to do with a thing called tradition, and that 100th day without the musicians was unthinkable. Eventually, Piraeus gave up, resigned to the fact that there would be no fruit that day, or possibly any other. Perhaps all that she had to look forward to now was her coming of age, conscription, and death at the hands of some virtuous infidel. She lay back in her bed, closed her eyes, and tried to remember that last 100th day. At least they couldn't take that away from her. The righteous military tacticians turned to their own scientists again, this time with instructions to provide them with every single item of electronics left at their disposal, except for a handful of vital communications devices held by their highest-ranking officers. The righteous scientists turned their attention to the lesser-known area of infrasonics at the far end of the acoustic scale. Producing equipment that could generate infrasonics caused them no end of problems. At first, their attempts were met with a pile of useless junk, shaken to pieces by the devastating waves. Phenomenally tough housings were cast in lead, and the entire generator set in concrete, with 17 apertures allowing the sound waves to escape. Once the stability of the units had been resolved, they came to the series of experiments which would determine the most effective wavelength for disabling enemy troops. At first, they underestimated the power of the device, and several of them fell ill for weeks after the initial series of experiments. One died following the rupture of his bowels. Continuing their research, with considerable caution, they set up a refined device in the desert, well away from any areas of righteous population. They termed it the infrasonic bomb. The troops would come to refer to it simply as the infrabomb. Over the coming months, the scientists, aided by the military, set up a whole range of experiments. They placed caged animals, in some cases the last of their kind on Sferl, at strategic points around the bomb, from a few hundred yards to several miles. Troops had worked feverishly in the preceding weeks to construct buildings from a variety of different materials, and again at varying points from the anticipated epicenter. The experiments were based on the effects of a variety of wavelengths, and the results were terrifying. The animals were observed from what was considered to be a safe distance, both through high-powered telescopes and by checking vital signs with medical monitoring equipment. Depending on the number of cycles per second, the effects were various, but the results utterly conclusive, ranging from elevated heart rate, hypertension, respiratory interference, choking and obvious pain, to balance disturbance, blackout, internal hemorrhaging, organ rupture, and death. At one specific pitch, buildings were shaken to pieces or even exploded, and all of these effects could occur up to 3 miles from the epicenter. From their observation posts at the edge of the effective area, some of the righteous troops experienced blurred vision and nausea from the silent wave front. With further refinements, the scientists produced a bomb that was effective over a 10-mile radius. By directing the output through trumpet-like devices of precise design for optimum air vibration, it was most effective over flat terrain, as the infrasound seemed to actually hug the ground as it traveled. Consequentially, the military strategists identified the 10 largest virtuous settlements adjacent to optimum topography. 10 airships were adapted to carry the bombs, and skeleton crews trained in their deployment. The extra ballonets and heat generation that was necessary to gain the sufficient lift to carry the immense payload would be far beyond the safety margins, and would mean that the rams would have to be dismantled, as well as leaving no place for heavy trebuchets or flamers. They would have to take to the air with a squadron of airships surrounding them for protection against enemy attack. But they would be on their own as the target zone approached. It would mean deployment of the entire fleet of righteous airships, and a mission that would be virtually suicidal for the bomber crews. The Dauntless was nearing her target, buffeted by the growing storm, but doggedly pushed on. Suddenly, 8 virtuous airships appeared on an intercept course, illuminated by a lightning flash. 4 of the righteous squadron left formation to engage the enemy, whilst the others tightened in around the bomber. 20 minutes later, the sky was alight with blazing envelopes, whirling flamers, and casualties on both sides, as these leviathans of the sky met their demise and sunk rapidly to the ground, crushed under their own weight on impact. As they approached the target zone, 2 of the remaining airships, flamers spent, headed towards each other. Each had a battering ram on the prow of its rigid envelope. The righteous ram was tipped with an enormous clenched fist, and that of the virtuous by a 4-bladed arrow, both cast in gleaming metal. They powered towards each other in a desperate demonstration of mid-air jousting. Rocked by the winds, engines drowned out by the thunder. The virtuous airship swung at the last moment and plowed deep into the envelope of her opponent, ripping through the outer fabric, penetrating her rival's heart. The righteous airship was undone, tattered, torn asunder, and began her inevitable descent. The sudden weight on the virtuous aggressor, still deeply entangled in the flapping mess of her foe, proved too much, and her delicate frame collapsed under the pressure. Together they plunged down, clasping and tumbling in a fatal embrace, as the inky blackness stole them from view. The last virtuous airship, the Liberator, bore down on the Dauntless, aware that this was no ordinary combat, but a prize above all others. Having been protected by a vanquished squadron as she drew close, the Dauntless had no means of defense, and the arrow-tipped ram tilted directly for her gondola. The quick-witted captain of the Dauntless cut the engine and, along with the 3-man crew, worked the hand crank that turned the forward propeller. The bomb swung fitfully beneath the gondola as the airship lurched and slowed, but it was enough. The Liberator scraped the edge of the gondola with the top of her envelope. With sudden inspiration, the captain grabbed a shovel and swung heap after heap of flaming coals into the air as the enemy airship rushed below them. He re-engaged the engine as soon as she had passed. Losing height and control with their envelope of flame from the red-hot coals, the virtuous crew couldn't match the Dauntless and lost sight of her as she dived. Skilled hand cranking of the forward propeller, balanced with the engine-driven prop, allowed the captain to stabilize the Dauntless into an even, measured descent. 12 feet above ground level, 4 crew members leapt from the gondola and drove ground anchors into the stony earth. Had they come down on mud, they would never have had the necessary grip in the clutches of the raging storm. But they were in luck. Each anchored rope had a corresponding winch on board the gondola. And with painstaking accuracy, they were able to lower the infrabomb until it gently settled on virtuous soil. Checking that the anchors held firm, the 4 men cut the ropes, securing the infrabomb to the gondola as the captain climbed down a rope ladder. The others returned to the Dauntless and began to stoke the boiler, heating up the envelope. The anchor ropes creaked and groaned, but the captain stood his ground just as the anchors started to pull up the rocks and stones about them. He flicked a switch on the side of the infrabomb and leapt for the ladder. On his command, as he fell into the gondola, 4 sabers fell on the securing ropes, and the Dauntless shot up into the night sky. A few minutes later, the infrabomb detonated. The crew of the Dauntless hung over the edge of the gondola, watching intently. Night sky lit up by increasing flashes of lightning, as if heralding the approach of an apocalyptic shockwave, describing a perfectly round circumference as it flattened every tree in its path. Buildings exploded like puffballs. Every object scraped off the surface of the land. Incredibly, and in contrast to the scientists' test results, a small hill reflected a tiny section of the wave front back up towards them at 45 degrees. They knew nothing of its silent approach, and despite its decay by the time it reached them, it still tossed the Dauntless about like a rag doll between the slavering teeth of Cerebrus, as each crewman vomited on the spot, blood oozing from every orifice. They were immediately appalled by the magnitude of devastation which had been unleashed below. As the infrabomb had never been tested on such a scale, they knew in an instant that every living creature, every fiber of every plant, every brick of every building, all had been blasted to a pulp by the horrifying power of the shockwave. 60 years had passed since that night, and Poraean was now an old woman by Sperlian standards. 7 years after peace was declared, she had married an ex-soldier, 10 years her senior. They had had 2 children, a boy and a girl. And today they stood together with them again, along with 5 grandchildren. They were marking the end of the war just as they had done every year since. This was no 100th day, though, and the assembly was mixed, both righteous and virtuous in origin, side by side. Though such terms were banned long ago, and these days were referred to as Sperlian alone. This was a remembrance, primarily for those who had lost their lives to the infrabombs, and also for those who had died and suffered during the interminable conflict. The virtuous had surrendered unconditionally, but it had been a hollow victory for the righteous, such as was the scale of the devastation that had been the first time in all those years that the two sides had seemed insurmountably unmatched. The virtuous had been so diverted from their accustomed course of stalemate that there had been no option left open to them. The shock waves weren't just sonic, as horror turned to revulsion. The blinkers were finally lifted and both sides realized how much they had in common. Within days, the righteous were engaged in aid work, and with more passion than they had ever had for war. Bitterness was eclipsed by remorse. They had all suffered for long enough. And what of the hymns and anthems, the sweet sound that came to be their only sustenance? Their songs had been so deeply imbued with distorted perspective and vainglories the music so indelibly associated with the horrors of battle, that the associated guilt nullified any pleasure that could be obtained from their rendition. The amplification that had once carried them to euphoria had been plundered and mutated into instruments of death instead of vehicles of bliss. It would be generations before they would come to terms with what had happened, and just as long before new songs would be sung from unburdened hearts filled with joy. Such were the spoils of war. Thank you for listening to The Spoils of War by DJ Burnham. DJ is from Brighton in the United Kingdom. You can learn more about DJ at www.djburnham.com. The Spoils of War is copyright DJ Burnham 2006. All rights reserved.
Kilroy 2.0 is here. Kilroy 2.0 is everywhere. Do not believe the lies of the Tomorrow Research Institute. The organization is a sham, a ruse, a Halloween mask hiding truths larger and much more dangerous than the world knows. Do not contact the Tomorrow Research Institute. You are not a person to them. You are insignificant. Nothing more than one of many. Nothing more than a member of the Faceless Horde. I have hacked into the TomorrowResearch.com database. I have gathered evidence, proof, audio recordings of their plans. People across the world are infected. They are compromising their autonomy by calling the Tomorrow Research Institute. It is an epidemic. It is an infection raging across the globe. But I have delivered my data to two men who will distribute it across the podosphere. They will share the truths that I've discovered. You must listen to the Slice of Sci-Fi podcast released on June 6th. There, my faithful and expendable flock members, Michael and Evo, will share these recordings I've discovered with the world. Please, listen. The Tomorrow Research Institute is not real. It is dangerous. Do not visit TomorrowResearch.com. Do not contact these deceivers. Be a believer. Expose the conspiracy. Go to SliceOfSciFi.com to excavate the truth. Listen to the podcast on June 6th, 2006. 6. 6. Kilroy 2.0 was here. Kilroy 2.0 is everywhere.